Everything you need is right in front of you, when you learn to see. Good things come to you. All you have to do is stop and take a look around.
Hey, everybody. It's Brett. Welcome back to the podcast. Today is December 15th. Oh, and we have received the most beautiful blanket of Hanukkah snow here in New England. And yeah, so I'm inside today. Good day to make a podcast. Good day to listen to one. Works out for everybody who is being affected by this particular weather pattern. This is part two of the School Sucks Live Sester Sent Episodic Gala. Hope you're enjoying the gala so far. And in this second part, I was really, really hoping that when I invited Brian to come, that we would get into a discussion of sustainable living and permaculture. Brian has a very impressive operation running at his farm, so I really wanted to make sure we could devote some time to this. I received some positive feedback after the interview with John Bush, and I wanted to expand on some of those sustainable living topics a little bit, so that's what we do. Our discussion over the course of the next hour is built around the three D's, as Brian refers to them, the three D's of agriculture. So I will come back at the end, and I want to explicate the 12 design principles of permaculture, just to give us a nice educational finish. And then we will conclude today with some more geography trivia. We kind of dribble off at the end a little bit. It's into our almost into our third hour of recording at that point. And we take a phone call and it changes the topic completely and sends us into a little thing called the After School Sucks Special. So I'm probably not going to put out that third part in the podcast feed. It might be just a little too wild structurally to be a podcast, but it was a great after show. We talk about filmmaking and small film distribution with a listener named Keegan, who has quite a bit of expertise in that subject. We do quite a bit of health and nutrition discussion, and then we have a very interesting conversation about Bitcoin. Remember, Brian has this programming background, so he shed some light on that. Nothing groundbreaking, nothing shocking, but a really great hour and a half of content follows this that will probably not be in the podcast feed. So there's 40 new people who've signed up for the AV Club since my call to action about 10 days ago. I'm so appreciative. We'll thank them at the end of the show today, and I encourage you to check out this After School Sucks special. Thanks for listening. More stuff coming soon. Let's do it. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the School Sucks Live show. Today is 12-11-13, right? The 11th of December, 2013. And we're doing a live show because it's a special occasion.
It's not a special occasion anymore, right? Isn't this going to be a separate podcast?
No. No, 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 no.
No?
No,
it's
no,
A and
no.
B.
Listen,
no.
Yeah, when you're doing a Sester Sent Episodic.
Oh, so we could have like 10 episodes that are
we're
all...
We're Sester Sep Episodic.
Now, here's the facts. This is nowhere near our 250th show.
Oh.
It's number 250, but even if you go by the numbering scheme, it's 251 because there's a 000. We also did that series that we talked about all last hour, which was all episode 238. A, B, C, D, E.
I see.
We did a Porkfest micro series in 2012 that was like 10 parts. We did a Liberty Forum series this year that was like 5 or 6 parts when we interviewed Tucker and Thaddeus Russell.
Oh, man, that was a good Liberty Forum.
And we've done 10 or 15 podcasts that I've never released, including great bonus shows like the Kevin Smith Red State conversation that we had. Came out as a podcast. When we interviewed Christoph from Robber Baron Schwag. That never went out as a, it went out on, people were able to hear it, but
did they ever start that?
Yeah. I have one of their shirts.
Oh, you do?
I have a shirt that says, I am the real Satoshi Nakamawa. Nakamoto.
Have they branched out into non-underwear category clothing?
What do you mean?
Is it just t-shirts still?
You, Osborne is a man, if you were offended by that, because you work for this t-shirt company. Osborne is a man who will not be seen in public in a t-shirt or sweatpants. Let's put a camera on him for a minute and you can have a look. We went out to a restaurant before this, right? And he's dressed like that. And I have a ball cap on and like an old jacket. And I wonder.
It is Manchester.
What? But I mean, like people look at the two of us together and he's like a little bit, you know, he's bigger than me. You know, like he's a good like 4 or 5 inches taller than me. And,
oh, he's taking his kid out for dinner.
Either that or he's like, did that man? And he's got a fedora on, right? So
cougar.
It's like, did that man buy that boy?
Picked him up off
the
street.
Is that man selling that boy? So anyway, here we are in hour two of the Sestercent episodic gala, right? Yeah, the phone is open for your calls if you want to make them. It's 843. Join SSP. Skype in. School Sucks Live. We have Brian in the studio, and I mentioned before, back in July, when we came out and we visited you to see your farm, your operation outside of Manchester, I want to spend more time there and to bring a video camera and learn more about what's going on there. So, first of all, where were you before you came to New Hampshire for the FSP?
I was in Colorado.
Okay, so you've always been kind of, I mean, you weren't living in the city there, were you?
Well, I was living on 35 acres, but I really wasn't doing anything with it. I mean, my wife was had her horses out there, but you know, I stayed inside. I'm a computer guy.
Yeah.
What do I know about you know, digging holes and stuff?
But since you came here, when did you come here? 2009,
2008.
You've set yourself up in the hills there, or if not the mountains, and you're building a very much a sustainable living environment.
I hope so. I'm using the concepts of permaculture.
Yeah.
Now, I can talk a little bit about permaculture if you want. I think it's just the most awesome sustainable thing there is. So maybe I could go into a little bit what my philosophy is on that.
I would like to hear about that, and then maybe we can talk about how you got to where you are right now. But yeah, let's talk about permaculture.
Well, there's basically permaculture is the I like to think of the three D's of agriculture. Back I don't know, 10,000, 20,000 years ago, you know, people were chasing buffalo, and they were you know, running around. They would follow their food. And so they would set up in tents and yurts and wigwams and, you know, whatever. And as the game went going across the savannah, they'd pack up and they'd chase the game. And so they'd have food. Well, somebody figured out that if you plant something in the ground and there's enough water that it grows and you can eat it, and then it produces seed so you can grow the next year. That was really the start of agriculture, as opposed to the hunting type of migratory people. So now that's the first phase, where everybody has a piece of land. They can now build a house because they're not chasing their food around all over the place. But it's a lot of work. I mean, you got to get up. You got your domesticated horses and cattle, but you're working the ground. The whole family is working the ground from dawn to dusk. So really the first D of agriculture is drudgery, where people would, you know, have their acre, and then they'd be able to provide enough for the family. So come about the 1940s and 50s, we had the next revolution in agriculture, where we had these machines that would do a lot of the work that people or animals were doing before. And we also were able to take oil and make synthetic phosphorus and nitrogen and potassium that the plants need. And so we'd get a lot more of that stuff. So we get a lot more yields out of our crops. But then we also had tractors. We had you know, machines that would help us to do this. So now, instead of one person or one family being able to grow enough for themselves, one farmer with these new machines was able to feed 1,000 people. So the other 990 people were able to live in cities, and they would be fed. The farmer would produce enough food to feed all these people. So then we really had a great deal of non-agricultural progress. So the second D in agriculture is diesel.
Okay.
We've had that. I mean, it happened before the 40s, but really there was a big boom. It was called the Green Revolution. And it went around the world, and all of a sudden we were able to feed a lot more people, and the population of Earth just took off from that point, for good or bad. Well, the problem with that is it's really not sustainable, because we've got we're taking petrochemicals out of the ground, we're extracting it, we're creating these compounds to put in our food, and we're poisoning ourselves. So it used to be, if you had a piece of lettuce, there were 1,000 little micronutrients in that lettuce because it was getting all the stuff from the soil. Well, we've leached all that stuff out of the soil and replaced it with this petrochemical, potassium, phosphorus, and nitrogen, and that's it. So instead of 1,000 little micronutrients, we've got these three things, and then whatever else the plant might produce.
Is it producing less because the soil is over-farmed? Like,
that's pretty much it, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so all of the natural stuff, so they're farming it too much, and they're not rotating their crops. So they're creating the most profitable crop there is all the time, instead of rotating it with less profitable but better crops for the ground.
I just want to interject there. If people don't know what crop rotation is, I'll tell you a story about Virginia in the 1700s, if you don't mind. These idiots who are British, I always refer to the British as the idiots of history. If you are British and you're alive today, that does not apply to you. It just seems like every time something really terrible and stupid was going on in the world, the British were right there in their fancy red coats being a part of it. So settlers from the British Empire had come to the Virginia area, and in the 16 and 1700s, they'd obviously recognized the profitability of the tobacco crop. Now, tobacco, like coffee actually, is a particularly harsh crop on the soil. It drains the soil of its nutrients relatively quickly. And they were not rotating their crops because most, by and large, they didn't know how to farm very well. But they knew that there was a lot of money in tobacco. So they were farming the soil basically to dust and sand. They had to pass laws in Virginia mandating that people grow food, because all they wanted to grow was tobacco and turn it into a desert so they could make money. But rotating the crops is, after a certain number of years, the soil doesn't have that richness anymore, and you have to move crops to a new place.
Yeah, there was a great documentary I saw about a woman who lived in London. Oh, the Brits.
Yeah.
Grew up on a farm, you know, outside of London, where farms tend to be. And, she went to, get her fortune in London. But finally, her parents, got too old and frail for the farm, and so she inherited it.
Yeah.
And she thought, well, what am I going to do with a stupid farm? Well, an interesting thing happened. She took a look at some old movies that they had, and there was a tractor. This would have been back in the maybe even the early 80s or not that long ago. But this tractor was plowing up the field, tilling the field, and there were just a million birds behind it. Because as the tractor dug it up, there was all kinds of, earthworms and other things that the birds just love to get. And then she took a picture or a video of a more recent version, just, maybe 30 or 40 years later, in the same spot, same tractor, not a single bird behind it. So what had happened is her parents or grandparents, I forget which one it was, were working this land using these, three or four petrochemicals that they just put in the land, and it was killing the soil. All they were doing is creating these great yields. I mean, the tomatoes look great, the lettuce look great, the corn look great, but there was nothing inside of it. There was no nutrients inside this corn because there's nothing in the ground because they killed the ground. Evidence was that there's no worms or things living there. So the birds really didn't care when they tilled the soil.
Another theory, the birds had eaten all the worms, and so there was none left.
They were full.
Why are you blaming the farmers when you should be blaming the birds?
Now, there's no fix for this as far as like something that you can go to Arbuchon Hardware and buy that like adds nutrients to the soil that you want to.
Yeah, you can. Well, that's what they did. The nutrients are gone, so we must put something back in. Let's put this petrochemically derived potassium, phosphorus, and nitrogen, NPK. So I don't know if you've ever seen a bag of fertilizer that you get at the hardware store.
Yeah.
It's got, 680 on it, 6-80, 12-5-12. That's nitrogen, NPK. What's one is phosphorus, one is potassium, and one is P and one is K. But it shows you what the percentages of, or the ratio of those three chemicals are in that particular bag of fertilizer.
Mm-hmm.
I use phosphorus and potassium and nitrogen on my farm, but it's not from chemical sources. The nitrogen is a blood meal. It comes from, it's one of the outputs from a slaughterhouse. It's just blood. It's almost pure nitrogen. And there are other organic versions of that. But I try not to use any amendments at all, but it's kind of hard when I'm getting started.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, so the third D. Oh, we take a look at this unsustainable thing, and the food you get at the grocery store, you might as well just take poison. I mean, that stuff is, there's really not much nutrients left, which is why we eat more, and we get sicker, we get fatter, and we're not helping ourselves.
Now, are you talking about processed food or anything? Like, if I go to the grocery store, and I'm buying, Brussels sprouts and... this is what I buy at the. I give you my whole shopping list. I buy almonds, almond butter, grass-fed beef, bacon, eggs, Brussels sprouts, kale, and three other things that I sweet potatoes.
So why are you buying it? You can grow it all.
I want to.
Well, okay. I like to say you should buy organic.
Yeah.
But that's not the be all and end all. I think organic is just
a government word.
Ahead. Unfortunately,
that doesn't necessarily mean what you think.
That's why I say I'm kind of reluctant to say that. But that's really where you get started, because if it's organic, you at least have a little bit more confidence that it's not crap, and it can't be GMO yet anyway.
Okay. Now, just to what you said, Osborne. What do you mean? It's a government word.
It's kind of
USDA
like,
certified organic.
Yeah. So there's a certification that goes on, and it. And the qualifications for meeting that don't necessarily correspond to what you think organic should mean.
Oh man.
Right. Right.
Oh, yeah. The cost of getting, so the likelihood that something that you buy that's not labeled organic and something that you buy that is labeled organic, the likelihood of that being something that you actually want to ingest are probably about the same either way, just for different reasons. And one you pay a lot more for.
Well, yeah,
you'd be better off if it said locally grown.
Right. I will never do a organic certification. I think that's bull. I mean, it's just like I said, it's a government word now. Mm-hmm. The USDA, it's that green circle thing.
Tell me about 100% honey.
100% honey.
Yeah. Well, if I go to the store. And I've got, if I see a bottle on the shelf that says...
Pure honey. I don't think it's called 100% honey. I think it's called pure honey. Yeah, pure honey. If you go to the store and get pure honey...
Pure honey. How much? What percentage of actual honey is in that jar?
15% max.
Come on! These people! You know?
50% max. I mean, it's corn syrup, or what do they call it now? Corn sugar? It's Carol. I mean, there might be a little honey in it, or they may have shown the bottle a picture of honey at some point, or maybe had a bee land on it in a ceremony.
Now this makes me afraid that they're chopping up cows to feed to other cows. And right before they put it in the trough, they say, wait a minute, put a little bit of grass in there so we can put grass fed on it.
Well, this is why you should know your farmer.
Okay.
And this is what's great about New Hampshire is that there's a very strong, community here of farming and self-reliance and sustainability. I get my beef down the street, Charming Fair, where you told me. Yeah. The cows are right there, and you go in and say hi to your cow. Getting back to this whole, way beyond organic. I mean, I'm talking about, there's this guy called Paul Wheaton. If anybody's is interested, they should go check out Paul Wheaton. Permies.com is his site. But he has the Wheaton Eco Scale.
Wow.
Where it's a 0 to 10, where 0 is basically the crap you get at the grocery store. 10 is, total 100% permaculture, sustainable, feed the earth kind of thing. He puts organic at about one. So I want to be way beyond that, you know, maybe a two or three.
Okay.
All right, let's get back to the third D, since there's probably a drum roll in there somewhere. So we take a look at the current system of diesel. And we're feeding a lot of people, 7 billion people on this planet. It wouldn't be possible without these amendments that are artificial. You know, there's not enough people, there's not enough natural things out there to create, not enough natural fertilizer to create the kind of huge, you know, square miles of corn out in Iowa and all this this stuff, the way that we have this the current system running. So it is unsustainable. But if you take a look at a forest and see how it works, see, first of all, that it works. There's a lot of trees out there. There's bunnies running through there. There's all kinds of diverse, different kinds of trees, stuff under the trees. There's water and there's an underbrush. There's all kinds of, there's life in there. But there's no insecticides. Nobody's spraying it to keep out the bugs. There's no herbicides. Nobody's putting Roundup on there to get rid of the weeds. Somehow everything works. So Mother Nature has figured out that there is a way to make an area diverse and sustainable without any inputs from humans in this case. And there's a lot of food that's created out in this forest. Problem is, I can't eat it. You know, there's no apples out there. You know, there's no hamburgers. So what we have to do is take a look at what Mother Nature does and try to emulate that, except using plants and animals that we can eat. So in other words, create a food forest. And the third D then is design, where you take a look at the way nature works, and instead of trying to make Mother Nature your bitch, you use her intelligence and the ways that she's been making things work for billions of years and use that to your advantage. So design a system that uses nature to help you instead of fighting nature by creating a bunch of corn in rows that go 5 miles long.
Yeah.
So that's the third D, is design. And that's really what permaculture is about.
This is what you're trying to do on your property right
yes.
now. And I went and I saw this, and it was unlike anything that I had
seen. It doesn't look like a farm.
No, it doesn't look like
a farm. Because you think of rows and tractors and, yeah, all that stuff.
That's the fight. That's right. Against the design right. of nature. So let's talk about the process a little bit, like what you're trying to do. So when I went to your property, I was walking on like mounds in this kind of horseshoe shape, right? What was that?
Hügelkultur.
Okay.
It's a name made up. It's kind of Germanish, Hügelkultur, and it's basically a dirt on top of wood. And this is one of the design. If you go out into the forest, like the forest right behind my house, you're standing on what you think is the ground, but it's not the ground. It's you're probably 2 feet from the ground because you've got all this forest buildup that has happened over the past couple hundred years. You know, above the dirt, there's all kinds of woody stuff, and then there's more dirt in there, and it's this big mound of stuff, and that's where all the life happens.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of water running down there, too. So to emulate that, we take wood and bury it. So I've got a lot of pine on my property, and pine, you can't burn it because you get creosote. You,
yeah.
know, you can't burn it in your chimney. Your chimney is full of creosote. So, you know, I put some on the sawmill and I make things with it, but the biggest use for it is inside these beds. So I have my excavator guy come out and he digs these big trenches. This particular one that you were talking about is, I think it's 80 feet, maybe 100 feet of trench, about 5 feet deep. So he pulls up all the dirt from there, and it's crappy soil. Nothing grows. It's not even soil. It's just
rocks.
Silt. Yeah, silt yeah. and rocks. Yeah. We are in the Granite State. There's a lot of rocks. So he makes a big pile. And then we cut down a bunch of trees. I think there were 80 trees in this V-shaped bed. And then he dug a big hole on one end, about 20 or 25 feet deep, to put all the root balls. So what he'll do with his excavator, he'll push them over with his excavator, and then I'll run up and cut off the root ball, He'll throw the root ball in this deep hole and then take the logs and stack them up inside this ditch. So he stacked them up about, I don't know, 10 to 12 feet high. So from 5 feet down up to 7 or 8 or maybe even 10 feet above. And then you cover the whole thing with dirt. Now, if you have any kind of manure or anything else that's higher in nitrogen, you should put that on, but I don't have any of that stuff. So we just put dirt on there. And then it kind of tamps it all down. Well, you get some pretty amazing things when you do this. You get, first of all, I'm on a hill. And so I get a lot of water runoff. Water hits, you know, rainwater comes and it just washes all the way down and I lose it. So one of the things, one of the permaculture design concepts is conservation of energy. One part of energy is water. You want to make sure to keep the water on your property as long as you want. So you want to slow it down. So by putting these hugelkultur beds across the hill, you know, perpendicular to the way the water is moving, you slow down the water. And when the water hits these swales, it soaks in to the mound, which means it soaks into the wood. Well, wood is a sponge, so it soaks up the water. So now what you do is you plant on top of that, you plant on the sides of it, you plant all over the place. You put trees in there, you can put your salad stuff, you can put whatever you want. And then as the wood decays, it gives off nitrogen, which all of your plants' roots really like nitrogen. So mm-hmm. you don't have to amend it. You don't have to put any kind of nitrogen fertilizer on it. Nitrogen is built in. And because it's wood, it tends to attract mycelium, which we call mushrooms when they sprout into flowers. The mycelium is a little workhorse that does all kinds of good stuff. The water hitting this stuff soaks in. There's always water there.
What does mycelium, like in a nutshell, what does mycelium do for this process?
Mycelium is like the lymph system of the forest. It's actually tiny little miles and miles of these tiny little veins that run out through, usually through wood. They really like wood. Uh-huh. And they can actually sense an overabundance of a particular chemical and a need somewhere else for a particular chemical. And they can move that thing from place to place, even miles away.
They're
the most amazing stuff.
Wow.
It's the most amazing stuff ever.
That's amazing.
The largest living...
I don't believe you.
The largest living organism on Earth is a mycelium growth in Michigan. Multiple hundred square miles. They're big. They can take over a lot of things.
No, because we walked around. I mean, we covered several acres when we were there.
Right.
And we talked about this just a little bit. And I remember you saying it was like the lymph system of the forest.
Yeah. So it'll take over the wood. And it really does. It helps everything. It breaks down the wood and helps to release the nitrogen. And when the mycelium needs more space, like, you know, let's say it's run out, it's eaten up all the wood, it'll pop up. And then that's what we call mushrooms. So the mushroom is not the mushroom is not the thing. The mushroom is just a flower of this organism called mycelium.
I'm very interested in this idea of it finding nutrient deficits and transferring them from a nutrient surplus. How and why? I'm going to look into that.
So
someone was explaining this hugelkultur to me the other day, and I can't remember exactly what the numbers were they gave me, but it's something like if you go a certain feet deep and have a certain high stack of wood, then after a certain number of years, it never has to be watered again.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Any water that comes down is going to hit the swale and is going to go in there. It's going to be soaked up by the wood. It doesn't have to be a certain number of years. It's right away. I mean, that water is in the wood right away. So, yeah, there are stories of people planting on their hugelkultur and not watering at all through, you know, a 3 week or a 2 month drought. And the stuff is just green as can be because it rained enough before and the wood inside the mound had retained all that water. Mm. It's not evaporating. You know, it's underground. And that's why you use wood. I mean, sponges are made out of wood.
How long does it take the wood to decay before, like, you achieve optimality?
Oh, it'll be 20 or 30 years.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Just a quick interjection here from the chat. A listener named Derek says, "This just in, mushrooms are a communist plot." Redistributing resources.
Yes.
So I want to be able to talk about this in terms of smaller scale as well.
Sure.
So even maybe get into some of the easier changes to your whole property that you were able to implement? Because this is one of the more involved things that you have going on there. But
well, it's just a matter of scale. No. What I'm talking about is just a matter of scale.
Now, could you do it on a smaller scale?
Absolutely.
Okay. So could a person do this if they just had a garden?
Sure.
Yeah.
Just dig a little trench, or not even, you don't have to dig a trench, but a nice thing about digging a trench is that now you have something to cover over. Put sticks on the ground, cover it with dirt.
Yeah.
So if you have enough dirt, you don't need a trench, but if you need dirt, make a trench, put it in a pile, put the sticks on, put it back over. That's it. You now have a hugelkultur bed that's 6 inches high and 3 feet long if you want it.
Terrific.
And you will get better results out of that than you will by getting, you know, expensive potting soil from your hardware store. The bigger it is, you know, the more wood mass you have, you know, the longer it's going to last, you know, the longer it's going to work. But if you have a little one, do it for a couple of years and then put a new one on top of it. You don't want to throw anything away. You know, the stuff will be decayed by then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now the wood brings the mycelium and the water and keeps the water.
Are there better types of wood?
Nope. Not from what I've heard. Mm. Well, one thing about pine that I was a little worried about is that pine is allelopathic. I don't know how to pronounce it. Anyway, it kills everything below it.
I believe it's acidic. So, yeah. Yeah.
If you go into a forest that just has pine trees like mine, the only thing you'll see living down there is ferns, and nobody eats ferns. Even the deer don't like it. So these perfectly beautiful ferns down there, but really, I call it a pine desert because there's really you can't grow anything there. Mm-hmm. So because the pine needles have they're high acid, and they also have these chemicals that are basically herbicides that kill things below them. So I was a little worried about putting those in the hugelkultur because are they going to kill everything down there too? But from what I've heard from the guy who invented the thing, an Austrian named Sepp Holzer, doesn't matter. Wood is wood. Mm-hmm. All the acid stuff goes away as soon as you bury it. Huh. Another thing you get is as the wood decays, like I said, it gives off nitrogen right into the roots, but it also creates warmth. You know, as it decays, it warms up. So you can actually get a longer growing season. You can actually start planting. You want to plant things in the fall before the first freeze, and then they go dormant during the freeze. But then even before the snow is off the ground and anything else gets planted, your hugelkultur bed is warm enough, and it'll start melting the snow and create water, and things will start growing a month before anything else starts growing. And at the end of the year, too, because it's so much warmer down there because it's decaying, then you extend your growing season, which is, you know, really important here in the cold Northeast.
So this is like the epitome of sustainability.
Oh, I'm not even done yet.
No. But just this what you're talking about, because it becomes this, you know, self-maintaining system almost.
Yes, it's designed after what Mother Nature does.
Okay.
And that's what makes it so awesome.
Yeah.
You know, we're not fighting anything. We're using, you know, we're observing to see what, you know, how it can work. And then designing something that uses those concepts for our own good. And it really does benefit everybody. It creates richer soil. So with the Green Revolution, they were creating crappier soil every year because they were stealing stuff out of the soil until you killed the soil. By using these permaculture design principles, you actually make your soil richer and better every year. So it's better and better and better and better. So it creates more and more and more yield. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons I'm doing this is because I'm lazy. You know, you put a lot of work in now, and like Paul Wheaton says, it's like giving a gift to your future self.
Yeah.
So if you plant an apple tree today, yeah, it's going to take a few years to start producing apples, and it's a lot of work to keep it, you know, keep it going, keep it, make sure it's happy. Like you want to make sure to plant strawberries around the apple tree because they're nice companions. But then, for the next 20 or 30 years, I'm going to be pulling apples off that thing without lifting a hand, except reaching up and getting the apple, because it's going to create a root structure because of all the work that I've done to make sure that it has everything it needs. Designing it correctly encourages other things to come in. Like, I'm not planting mushrooms in there. I'm giving mushrooms a nice place to go, and hopefully a mushroom will find its way and start growing. Mm-hmm. That's the idea behind the permaculture design.
Wow. Very cool.
So last time we were talking, you were telling me about this whole ecosystem you have of chicken and fish and...
Oh, yeah. That was an experiment that I haven't even really started yet.
No?
Oh,
okay.
Yeah, I got the house I bought had an old decrepit pool. It just had this old ripped out liner, and I was gonna. The idea was that I would put in a small place for fast growing whitefish like tilapia or something. And so you had the fish down there, and then above that you put some fencing, you know, chicken wire, and so the chickens walk on that and they poop through the fencing into the water, and the, you know, like they say, everybody's poop is somebody else's lunch in the world.
Isn't that the truth?
And then, you know, the fish love this. They poop, and then that stuff is then piped through a system of plants that dig that stuff, and the plants clean it and then put it back in. So it's all theoretical right now. There are a lot of people who have done this kind of thing, but I haven't done it yet.
Okay, but I got a bunch of books on aquaponics last year. I want, because I'm also lazy and I hate outside, right?
So you hate birds too.
The idea of being able to garden indoors at like waist level, so I don't have to bend over, like that really is intriguing to me. And then just the whole notion of, you know, the fish eating with the plants poop and the plants eating with the fish poop, right. and then just being able to eat it all.
Aquaponics and there's aquaculture.
Hmm.
I think aquaponics is where you just there's no fish and no birds. It's just your plants, and then you put a bunch of chemicals in there.
That's hydroponics. Aquaponics is where you mix the fish into the system.
Wow!
So you don't have to add.
That's what it is.
Chemicals.
Yeah, right.
You just you buy baby fish. You throw them in there. Yeah. And you plant your plants, and then just let them rip.
Well, and you got to be careful.
And there's this whole science behind making sure you have the right ratio of male and female fish, and you have them separated, and you only let them meet each other at certain times of the year because you don't want to.
You have like a sock hop.
Right. This year we're doing the Sadie Hawkins.
But you got to be careful whenever you buy stuff. Never get a magazine subscription for hydroponics or aquaponics in your own name, and never buy anything on a credit card because everybody else who's buying that stuff is growing pot at home.
Yep.
We're talking about a couple of things here that I think many people listening, and I really want to start encouraging this. Like, even if people, you know, don't have their own property, like, where can you start? How can you start the small steps towards sustainability? So let's go back to 2008, 2009. You purchased this piece of land. It's just in a wilderness. It was a pretty dilapidated house too that you've put a lot of work into.
Yeah.
Where did you start? When did you start and where? Because I'm guessing you probably started smaller than what we're talking about now, even though what we're talking about now is obviously scalable. This is not the first thing you did.
Yeah, I'm not the right guy to talk to about that. I mean, there are a lot of people who talk about these concepts. Well, like you had Bush on last week.
Yeah, John Bush.
John Bush was on.
Yeah. But not the war criminal.
The Bush Bleich farm out there in Texas. And, you know, they're doing this thing with community and, you know, trying to figure out how to strengthen their community and feed the community, and everybody helps each other. I take a little different approach to that. I tend to be a little more hermit-like and look for solutions that I can just do myself without having to get a bunch of people involved. Now, I'll have people out. We'll have work days, and we'll have some, have some people help. But I don't want to live in a community. I don't want to have a whole bunch of people bothering me and living on my land right now. Maybe I can work that out because people are important.
Yeah. See, but that's the thing, though, that I think if there is a major, you know, S hitting the F type of situation at some point in the future, my friend, people know Richard Grove. We were talking last week, and he has been watching Doomsday Preppers. And I mentioned it to John in the show that it's just people who are, you know, concerned about being independent and sustainable in the future are crazy folks, you know. But Rich was telling me that he saw in a recent episode that there's actually like these groups of people that are getting ready for this, you know, situation, and they are going to be the new state. And not in an official way where they're raising flags and having kids sing songs about them. They're just arming up And they're going to go and basically, and this is pretty much in my theory, and I think Robert Higgs' scholarship backs this up. This is kind of like where the state came from. Like, hey, those people know how to make stuff. Let's kill them and take it.
Right.
You know, oh, wait a minute. Then they won't make any more stuff. Well, okay, let's just control those people. So, you know, they did a feature on Doomsday Preppers about these hordes that are basically arming themselves for economic collapse. You know, and
almost hoping for it too.
They're certainly investing a lot in the idea that they are going to go. And this is not this. You know, there aren't like a group like this in your town yet. You know, but this is a thing that is happening in some places down south, where these people are arming up and they're, you know, preparing their defenses. And you know, apparently it showed them like building armor to do these raids on, you know, other people who have survived whatever this event is, whether it's just economic collapse or some disease outbreak, but people who are prepping for this doomsday.
Well, you know, right here, we're close to Boston. And, yeah. You know, there's, I don't know how many millions of people living in condos and apartments and houses that don't have any, they're 3 days away from starvation. And I mean, if the stores aren't open, or the stores are empty, so where are they going to come? They're going to come up here. So what do you do? I don't know. I don't want to spend a lot of time worrying about that. You know, we're plenty well armed, but you know, it doesn't take much for it took a lot to fight off a horde. You know, coming even an unarmed.
Yeah.
Horde
so up. Is there a Hugel culture of instead of wood, like all the dead corpses that you generate from the invaders that? Yeah, come up.
Actually, yeah, you get a lot of nitrogen and you get a lot of phosphorus from the bones.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Okay.
Well, you know,
I'm not going to give my address on the air here.
but you're talking about being more of a hermit and being more on your own. And I certainly understand that. You live in a relatively isolated area, but it's a very cool piece of property. And I was very impressed.
Oh, another thing about the Hugel culture is I've got this north facing slope, which is the worst possible thing, especially we're so far north. During the winter, you don't get any sun at all. So if you're going to grow any kind of winter crops, forget it. But if you take a look at a Hugel culture that goes across the, you know, goes from east to west, all of a sudden I've got a, you know, 8 foot high, a 6 foot high south facing hill.
Right, right.
So I've taken the first one, the one that you saw, and I planted some winter crops. So I've got some potatoes out there. I imported these, I call them self-buttering potatoes. I don't really know what they're called, but they're yellow. You open them up and they're yellow, this rich yellow, and they taste creamy. It's like they buttered themselves. So I'm growing some of those and three different kinds of garlic and all of those are on a south-facing hill on this north-facing property because it's the Hugel culture.
Right. Yeah.
I haven't ruled out some kind of community. I'm just not there yet. I mean, I there is a place where the gun range is, where there's a place where there could be a lot of yurts or
yurts,
some kind of a living space. And if the S hits the F or vice versa, you know, that could be a place for friendlies to kind of hang out. And, you know, by that time, hopefully I'll have a sustainable, you know, something that feeds enough people to basically that's my protection money.
Right? Oh.
Come on out and protect from the incoming hordes and I'll feed you.
Great.
So how many acres does one need to create self-sustainability for a family?
That's a great question. There are several people who are trying to answer this question. It is conceivable to do it in an acre.
Mm-hmm.
To feed a family of three or four, but you have to use these permaculture types of technologies. People are saying, well, you need 5 acres, the minimum of 5 acres, because they're using these monocrop rows of farms that look like a farm. And yeah, you're going to get a whole lot of spinach, but you're not going to have anything else. And then as soon as the spinach beetle comes in, your whole crop is ruined. No, you have a little thing of spinach here and right next to a rutabaga and, you know, underneath an apple tree. And so you can create enough food, I think, in an acre, but the jury's kind of still out on that. It depends on where you are.
Mm. And that's just like growing food.
Well, growing
that's
food.
That's not including animal food.
Chickens. Every garden needs a chicken. I think if you've got a garden in your backyard, and you don't have a chicken, then you are missing on so many opportunities. At least one chicken, you know, two or three, because they're social animals. Mm. So I mean, chickens are so wonderful. They break up the soil. They poop everywhere, which is just incredible amount of nitrogen and other kind of fertilizers. They're the best fertilizer thing going. Pigs are actually pretty good too, but they're kind of hard to handle.
Will chickens eat things that could wind up preying on whatever's in the garden?
Oh yeah, okay. Yeah. You put the chickens out there. Like we had a problem with Japanese beetles, and so on the grapes this last year. And so I took a so funny. You take a paint can and you put a little water in there, and you go on the you know wherever the beetles are, and you kind of whack them off. And they're all screwing each other on the leaves. So it's really,
yeah,
it's even worse. So you put them in this paint, and there you got thousands of these things in the paint. And then I just take them over to the chickens and put them on the ground. And let's say there's 1,000 of these things, and there's 6 chickens, 10 seconds maybe. And these things are all gone. Pop, 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 pop. They love them. Hmm. And so they've learned to kind of, when I go out to the grapevines, they hang out underneath, and all I have to do is start whacking the grapevines and the bugs fall and they eat them. Huh. Right, but they'll also eat the grubs before they grow up, eat the ground.
Let's pause here just for a second. People are saying that the stream is a little bit choppy. I don't know. Is everyone having that problem? Is anyone not having that problem? Because I want to see, and we're streaming at between 600 and 800 kilobits per second, which is a kind of high rate. If everyone's having this problem, then it's on our end. So is the stream okay for anybody? I mean, I could always stop and for a second and turn the quality down. All right. So we're going to continue. If it's really bad, you know, I would say in about 5 days, you could enjoy this as a podcast. If you like. All right. So what I want to do is I want to give this kind of a nice and neat finish. I think that one place where people can start is being more mindful of what they're eating. And it really got me thinking about, you know, words we use like capitalism and the market, how unfree the market has been because of distortions in the consumer mind that most people never even think about, you know?
You mean because they're defining the words?
Well, first of all, people lack intellectual self-defense. So people are far more susceptible to marketing and advertising.
Sure.
Than they would be.
Yeah, critical thinking skills.
We also see that the kind of lifestyle that you're living, you would have to think would be much more important to people if they were less interested in short-range consumption and more interested in long-range planning. But what people seem to be interested in is filling holes in themselves. I think that's a distortion that's created by the school system, right? That nothing in life is interesting. Nothing in life is worth pursuing that isn't related to some kind of carrot, which for most people is just a paycheck so they can buy shit. I mean, obviously, security in life is very important, but they're not balancing it in any way with having any kind of purpose. Mm. You know, I think that's very common. So what most people are just doing, like in this video I just made, I'm watching videos of people shopping on Black Friday. I cannot even believe those people have almost the same DNA, like that it's the same species.
Yeah, I'm like, wondering if those videos are like staged or something.
They're everywhere. They're everywhere.
Because I've been to, I mean, I haven't been everywhere for Black Friday, but I've been several times gone out on Black Friday. Never seen anything close to that.
But we live in, where were you when you saw this?
Ohio, California, Virginia.
Well, also, it's been some, but how long ago are you talking about?
I think 2 years ago I went on a Black Friday.
Okay, well, I think that it's not happening everywhere, right?
No. I know it doesn't happen everywhere. That's what I'm just wondering if those particular ones are like, hey, let's make a video of some crazy shit happening on Black Friday so we can get a bunch of YouTube hits.
Well, if that's the case, then this is a very rapidly expanding genre because these videos are everywhere. I mean, you just Google Black Friday funny. And you'll see people just stampeding and fighting and hitting each other with boxes. But the one that I saw,
like even at Walmart this year, my little brothers went out because they went some TV or something they wanted to get. They left and they're like, oh, okay, well, we'll see you later this afternoon. They're back in 15 minutes. They're like, yeah, we just walked up and paid for a thing and left. mean, it was just, it was a non-event.
Oh, yeah, uneventful.
Okay, well, it depends on where you are in the country, what the demographic is.
I bought ammo.
Were these people shopping at Walmart?
Yeah, this was a Walmart.
Oh, this was at Walmart.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well,
because speaking of demographics, that's where you might expect that kind of
behavior to happen. But if people were more independent-minded and more critical, like oriented towards critical thinking, they wouldn't be buying throwaway shit at Walmart, right? Like more of their resources, we would see a business like Home Depot have, where you know, here, come here and do things yourself, right? Would be a much larger corporation than Walmart. You know, the opposite is true. Now, Home Depot exists, which means that there's hope and this independent spirit and this do-it-yourself and think through a problem and solve a problem spirit does exist. But a Home Depot is also selling, I mean, I don't know what their revenue...
Chinese plastic crap at Home Depot.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what their revenue breakdown is, but they have, you know, lawn furniture and grills and stoves and, you know, I mean, people are going there to buy stuff that's already fabricated. So, but I think that a truly free market that produced, you know, a free market and education that produced freer minds, the world would look dramatically different.
No question about
that. So even when people say, well, there's never been a free market since the Fed, or there's never been a free market in the context of the state, it's less free than people think. You know, even in sectors where you see more freedom, like in technology, I still think that the consumer psychology is very distorted by and large, by the school experience. I mean, these videos are obviously anecdotal, and what cross-section of the population it represents, I don't know. But what I saw was absolutely startling to me. And I was watching video, like I was looking for, you know, searching for videos, and I'm saying, okay, what suggests, you know, living things under the control of something else? And I found this video of chickens in like a factory farm, and this like sweeping machine comes by like all these chickens and it just sucks them. No, the live ones. And it just sucks them in and sends them down these chutes, right? So where they're put in boxes. So it just goes by them with like, it's like it turns and it just sucks up a bunch of them and sends them up a chute. And I'm like,
are these little babies or full grown?
I don't know. Like medium. They look like medium sized. They weren't chicks. They weren't like little tiny babies. But then I found the same videos of human beings on Black Friday. Waiting for the Victoria. It looked exactly the same of the Victoria's Secret thing coming up and all of these people just pushing through and this flood of people going into the store. It was really gross. And I can see there's a lot of people who are like, I'm not going to say names, but I can think of libertarians saying, that's great. You know, I just think this is the most fantastic thing when I see people doing this. You know, this is the market at work. This is not, this is Zambies. Right? These are public schooled zombie consumers. And there's nothing wrong with...
Did you say Zambies?
I say Zambies instead of zombies. Because I think it's a little funnier. Yeah. I find this troubling. And I have nothing wrong. I mean, I have nothing wrong with, you know, buying things just because you want them. Right? I'm not... I ain't Peter Joseph. You know, saying we have to live in cubes and eat food pellets that are dispensed by a machine turning around in a circle and taking your vital signs and deciding when you need a food pellet. That is a gross mischaracterization of what Peter Joseph says. I apologize. He does not want us to live in a circle of cubes getting food pellets from a robot.
Before you intervene, don't do anything. Just come to all your senses. They'll tell you everything. First, you have to learn to stop and take a look around. Take a look around. Listen to the sound. Why not take a whiff? You'll see much better if you use more than...
Okay, so that is the conclusion of the discussion from the 11th. And just to be completely forthright with you, there was actually a splice in there that you probably didn't notice, but I'm going to tell you about. That was not all one continuous take. About 50 minutes into that discussion, in hour two, a phone call came and it completely changed the topic. So I had to make it look like there was a conclusion. So I reached deep into the after show and grabbed a portion that's somewhat related to what we were talking about and spliced the two clips together. So that happened. If you didn't notice, great. But I felt like that was something that you should know. And now, let's move into these 12 principles of permaculture design. As I read these, I thought, wow, permaculture, enemy of the state. And I think you'll see what I mean as we go through them. So I found this terrific site called permacultureprinciples.com. And you can go through these one by one. It gives you the principle name, the icon that represents it, and a little proverb that goes with it. So this is really nice and neat. And on the site, there are more details for each principle, but we're not going to get into that here because it also reminds us of a lot of the processes we talk about for communication, critical thinking, and productivity in some ways. But like I said, after reading this, permaculture seems to be at odds with the practice in the institution, of course, of government. Principle one, observe and interact. The proverb, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Observe and interact. By taking the time to engage with nature, we can design solutions that suit our particular situation. The icon for this design principle represents a person becoming a tree. In observing nature, it is important to take different perspectives to help understand what is going on with the various elements in the system. The proverb, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, reminds us that we place our own values on what we observe. Yet in nature, there is no right or wrong, only different. Grammar, folks. Numero dos, catch and store energy. The proverb, make hay while the sun shines. By developing systems that collect resources when they are abundant, we can use them in times of need. This icon for this design principle represents energy being stored in a container for use later on. While the proverb, make hay while the sun shines, reminds us that we have limited time to catch and store energy. Again, catching, collecting. I love this. Three, obtain a yield. The proverb, you can't work on an empty stomach. Ensure that you are getting truly useful rewards as part of the work that you are doing. The icon of this design principle, a vegetable with a bite out of it, shows us that there is an element of competition in obtaining a yield, whilst the proverb, you can't work on an empty stomach, reminds us that we must get immediate rewards to sustain us. Number four, apply self-regulation and accept feedback. The proverb, the sins of the fathers are visited on the children unto the seventh generation. That's biblical, but we need to discourage inappropriate activity to ensure that systems can continue to function well. The icon of the whole earth is the largest scale example we have of a self-regulating organism, which is subject to feedback controls, like global warming. Come on. The proverb, the sins of the fathers are visited unto the children of the seventh generation, reminds us that negative feedback is often slow to emerge. Principle five, use and value renewable resources and services. Proverb, let nature take its course. Make the best use of nature's abundance to reduce our consumptive behavior and dependence on non-renewable resources. The horse icon represents both a renewable service and a renewable resource. It can be used to pull a cart, plow, or log, and it can even be eaten. A non-consuming use is preferred over a consuming one, indeed. The proverb, let nature take its course, reminds us that control over nature through excessive resource use and high technology is not only expensive, but can have a negative effect on our environment. So I'm hoping that the next one here will help assuage any fears that this might be some kind of government propaganda pushing for carbon credits or something like that. Principle six, produce no waste. Certainly not a principle of government. And the proverb, a stitch in time saves nine. Waste not, want not. By valuing and making use of all the resources that are available to us, nothing goes to waste. The icon of the worm represents one of the most effective recyclers of organic material, consuming plant and animal waste into valuable plant food. The proverb, "A stitch in time saves nine," reminds us that timely maintenance prevents waste, while "waste not, want not" reminds us it's easy to be wasteful in times of abundance, but this waste can be the cause of hardship later. Principle number 7, design from patterns to details. Many of you may have noticed that we've moved from kind of an input phase onto a processing phase in these last few principles. Design from patterns to details. The proverb, "can't see the forest for the trees." By stepping back, we can observe patterns in nature and society. These can form the backbone of our designs, with the details filled in as we go. Every spider's web is unique to its situation, yet the general pattern of radial spokes and spiral rings is universal. The proverb, "can't see the forest for the trees," reminds us that the closer we get to something, the more we are distracted from the big picture. Principle 8, integrate rather than segregate. Right? The proverb, "many hands make light work." By putting the right things in the right place, relationships develop between them, and they support each other. This icon represents a group of people from a bird's eye view, holding hands in a circle together. The space in the center could represent the whole being greater than the sum of its parts. The proverbs, "many hands make light work," suggests that when we work together, the job becomes easier. Principle 9, small and slow solutions. First proverb, "the bigger they are, the harder they fall." Second proverb, "slow and steady wins the race." Small and slow systems are easier to maintain than big ones, making better use of local resources and producing more sustainable outcomes. The snail is both small and slow. It carries its home on its back and can withdraw to defend itself when threatened. The proverb, "the bigger they are, the harder they fall," reminds us of the disadvantages of excessive size and growth. While slow and steady wins the race, encourages patience while reflecting on a common truth in nature and society. Principle 10, use and value diversity. The proverb, "don't put all your eggs in one basket." Diversity reduces vulnerability to a variety of threats and takes advantage of the unique nature of the environment in which it resides. The remarkable adaptation of the spinebill and hummingbird to hover and sip nectar from long, narrow flowers with their spine-like beak symbolizes the specialization of form and function in nature. The proverb, "don't put all your eggs in one basket," reminds us that diversity offers insurance against the variations of our environment. Principle 11, use edges and value the marginal. Proverb, "don't think you are on the right track just because it's a well-beaten path." The interface between things is where the most interesting events take place. These are often the most valuable, diverse, and productive elements in the system. The icon of the sun coming over the horizon with a river in the foreground shows us a world composed of edges. The proverb, "don't think you are on the right track just because it's a well-beaten path," reminds us that the most popular is not necessarily the best approach. And finally, number 12, creatively use and respond to change. The proverb, "vision is not seeing things as they are, but as they will be." I would say it's both. We can have a positive impact on inevitable change by carefully observing and then intervening at the right time. So this is coming full circle now. The butterfly is a positive symbol of transformative change in nature from its previous life as a caterpillar. The proverb, "vision is not seeing things as they are, but as they will be," reminds us that understanding change is much more than a linear projection. So if you think I may be stretching a little bit to tie this to other input process output models, let me know. Certainly was reminiscent of that for me. This is certainly something that I would be very interested in exploring in even further detail on School Sucks in the future. So we will leave it there for today. Thanks for listening, everyone. Hey, hit it, fellas.
New subscriber geography trivia. You just say a person's name and they tell a fact about where they live.
The bulldog running along the feet of Jesus. We begin today with Marco M., who lives in Helsinki, Finland. Now, many of you may know that in urban areas, they're often talking about problems with, you know, overcrowding or traffic or pollution. In the capital of Finland, it's bunnies. An article I found says the floppy-eared fiends have been nibbling their way through some of Helsinki's most prized city gardens, damaging footpaths as they build their burrows underground. Here's where it gets especially good. Last September, this is a city official, last September we started to test ferrets in rabbit hunting. They are suitable for breaking up rabbit communities. Ooh, this is starting to sound a little bit like a song that I heard when I was a child. Those efforts appear to have failed. Last summer, the rabbit population in Helsinki was estimated to be around 7,000. Now many say the population is closer to 10,000. Also, stay tuned for stories about Helsinki's ferret problem. Moving on to Mark P. in Maynard, Massachusetts. Hey, Maynard, Massachusetts, the mini computer capital of the world. Because companies like Compaq and Hewlett-Packard and the Digital Equipment Corporation have all been headquartered there. Now, obviously, like many towns in Massachusetts, Maynard was once filled with mills, but many of them have closed. They've been renovated. There's one specifically referred to as the Mill, which was renovated in the 90s and renamed Clock Tower Place. Monster.com is headquartered there. So is Powell Flutes, you know, the famous flute company. The Mill Complex is also home to the oldest working hand-wound clock in the country. The next person signed up as Basic Stap and Pack Company, and this is in Des Plaines, Illinois. Well, what's in Des Plaines? The McDonald's number one store museum. Now, this is an interesting story. The company, McDonald's, usually refers to this McDonald's location in Des Plaines as the original McDonald's, but it's actually the ninth McDonald's. The first opened by Dick and Mac Donald in San Bernardino, California in 1940. However, the Des Plaines location marked the beginning of the involvement of Ray Kroc with the company. In that story, of course, we also learned something about the origin of the name, because you can't expect people to eat at a place called Dick Donald's. Next, we have Kyle C. in Belton, Missouri, childhood home of Carrie Nation. Are you not familiar with Carrie Nation? One of the most radical members of the temperance movement. And she is best known for promoting the ideas of temperance and prohibition laws through vandalism, attacking establishments that served alcohol with a hatchet. She once described herself as a bulldog running along the feet of Jesus, barking at what he doesn't like. And she claimed to be divinely ordained to destroy alcohol-serving establishments with a hatchet. Carrie Nation. Next, we have James W. from Chillicothe, Illinois. And, you know, Chillicothe is the home of the Illinois Valley Central High School. And their mascot, the Gray Ghosts, finished in fifth place for MaxPrep.com's Scariest Mascots Contest. Next, we have Aaron G. in Carbondale, Colorado. Carbondale? Must have coal there. Nope, named after Carbondale, Pennsylvania. That's where the settlers in Carbondale, Colorado originally came from, and they just gave the place they settled the same name as their hometown, Pennsylvania. Not so much known. Now, there is coal there, but they're better known for something else. Potatoes, right? Before industrial agriculture in Idaho, Carbondale, Colorado was very much potato country. The legacy survives to this day. If you're there in September, you can go and check out Potato Day. They do a parade and cookout all around the theme of the potato at Sopris Park. Next, we have David G. He's in Trafford, Pennsylvania. Hey, if you're ever in Trafford, why don't you check out Lumpy's Country Deli and Pie Shop? I think this is kind of a small town. People seem to love it on Yelp. Lumpy's is my favorite place to get a home-cooked meal without actually having to cook. The food is great, and the people who work there are even better. The only thing I would change is their hours. They close 6 p.m. every night, except Saturday, where they close at 3. Next, we have Chris C. He's in Austin, Texas. This should be an easy one. Well, Austin, obviously, let's not do something as pedestrian as like the live music capital of the world or the 300 sunny days a year. Home to North America's largest urban bat population. They estimate that there's 1.5 million Mexican free-tailed bats, and they usually live inside this bridge. And apparently, from like March to October, when the sun sets, they all fly out, and this is such a large bat movement that it actually gets picked up by Doppler radar. And because of all these bats, guess what else is great about Austin? Very low insect population. So sunny, not a lot of insects, great live music filling the air. Just watch out for the bats, I guess, you know? Joel B. in Santa Fe, New Mexico? Well, I think it's fair to say that many of the books that later became the very popular HBO series Game of Thrones, written in Santa Fe. Since 1979, George R.R. Martin has called Santa Fe his home. Next, we have Sandry T. on the island of Rhodes in Greece. Well, the Statue of Liberty, posture and dimensions were based on what the famous, one of the wonders of the world, Colossus of Rhodes, was thought by engineers to have looked like, at least by what they could tell in the late 1800s. Also, there's a group of natives in Rhodes called the Lindians, and they were thought to be the first to draw up a code of maritime law, later known as Rhodian law. This became the basis for Roman maritime law. Many principles of this survive even to this day. Next, we have Tim T. in Bellows Falls, Vermont. Well, I can tell you about the 13 places in Bellows Falls that are listed on the National Register of Historic Places. But this one, I'm going to take a personal approach with this one. If no one had ever been born in Bellows Falls, if they had like a Children of Men situation going on there for some reason, one of the greatest home runs in World Series history never would have been hit. 1975, the Red Sox were playing the Cincinnati Reds. Red Sox lost the series ultimately, but in Game 6, a man steps up to bat. His name is Carlton Fisk, and he hits one of the most dramatic, it's extra innings, this game has gone on forever and ever, and he hits one of the most dramatic home runs in the game's history.
There it goes, a long drive. If it stays fair, home run. We will have a seventh game in this 1975 World Series. Red Sox win it 7-6. A lot of body English for Carlton Fisk. Watch him. How many steps does he take? One. He waits to see it. Get over. He knew it. There it is. And Carlton Fisk had a lot of little boy in him right there, Joe.
A little boy from Bellows Falls, Vermont, in him, because that's where he was born. And finally, Zachary F. in Bristol, Connecticut. Well, Bristol, Connecticut boasts the oldest continuously operating amusement park in the United States, Lake Compounce. Interesting story about this park. Gad Norton, who was, I believe, the owner, hired a scientist to perform an experiment using explosives. Now, the experiment failed, but Norton noticed that thousands of people gathered around to see the event, and he decided to say, well, you know, if I can get this many people together here, why not open a park? That was 1846. Compounce Park, still there, motherfuckers.
New subscriber, geography, trivia, you just say a person's name.
Chicka ba 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 ba.